Today is May 26, 2015. I'm at the Indiana Medical Historical Museum. My name is Angela Potter, and this is part of the Old Pathology Building Oral History Project with IUPUI. And I'm here with Dr. Jane Hutches. Thank you again for agreeing to this interview. So I want to talk a little bit first about your early life before you went to go medical school. When and where were you born?
I was born near Bluffton, Indiana, about 2 miles south of the country.
Okay.
Wells County.
Wells County, Indiana.
Mm-hmm.
And when were you born?
In 1933.
So did you spend your growing up years there?
I did. I lived in Wells County and graduated from Byrne High School in Adams County, right next door. And then I went to college here, went to Wabash College, and then Indiana University School of Medicine.
So, did you grow up on a farm? Was it a...
Yes, yes. When I was a boy, we lived on a farm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's a beautiful part of the state.
Near the Wabash River?
Yes, yeah. So, why did you decide Wabash College?
Well, we didn't have a lot of money then, and I qualified for a scholarship there, an honor scholarship, and that was very helpful. My father was a teacher, and he wanted me to go to a liberal arts college, and it is a liberal arts college.
Yeah.
And it was noted for pre-medicine, and I wanted to go to medical school.
So you decided you wanted to go to medical school even before you went to college?
Yes.
Do you remember when you decided you wanted to go, or what motivated you?
Well, I decided, I think it was in the junior, senior year in high school.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Did you know any physicians, or what made you decide?
Yes, I knew the family physician there in town. I can't recall if there were any other physicians that made me decide to go to medical school. I considered veterinary medicine also. My father suggested that I go to medical school.
So what was Wabash like then? That would have been in the 50s, I guess?
That was in the 50s.
Yes. Mm-hmm. After the war and...
Well, I don't think it's changed very much. Wabash is an old school since 1832.
Yeah.
And it was very good. I really liked my experience at Wabash.
So
I was in a fraternity.
Oh.
And I went to medical school after 3 years at Wabash.
Uh-huh, 3 years. Mm-hmm. So that was my next question. How, what was it like to apply to medical school then?
What was it like to find a medical school?
Apply.
Well, there are about 82 medical schools in the United States at that time, as I recall.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't easy to get in. It was very competitive. I applied only to Indiana.
Oh.
Because it was financially the best one, and I wanted to stay near home.
Excuse me, I'm headed out. You want to lock the door after me?
Yes, I will.
Okay, thanks. Just call Jim.
Okay. Okay.
So you started in 1954 at the IU Medical School? Is that correct?
Yes, it was in the fall of 54.
Mm-hmm. So did you begin classes at Bloomington, or did you start in Indianapolis?
Started in Bloomington.
Okay. So you did your first year or 2 years in Bloomington?
1 year.
1 year.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the hard sciences?
That was the basic sciences, anatomy, physiology, and histology, neuroanatomy.
A lot of people that I've interviewed have talked about their initial dissection and experience being one of the most memorable of their medical training. Was it hard for you, or
no,
was it?
No, it was just very interesting. I'm very interested in anatomy, physiology.
So then after your first year, you came to Indianapolis then?
Sophomore year.
Sophomore year. And where did you stay in the city?
Well, I got, let me see. I'm trying to remember the streets. Michigan Avenue. Mm-hmm. As you go south, or no, west on Michigan Avenue, there's a little street that's no longer there.
Oh, uh-huh.
Limestone Street.
Oh, yeah, I've seen reference to that.
And I stayed in a house. There was a married student and they had a room upstairs and they didn't have any money either. And they rented me and one of my classmates a room. And we roomed there for 1 year. And then I moved across the street on Limestone because I got married.
Oh, okay.
And we had had our daughter when I was, I guess it was when I was a junior.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Were there a lot of people in your class that were married?
There were fairly, quite a few.
They were starting to relax the rules.
I can't give you a number, but there were quite a few.
It wasn't uncommon.
Quite a few that were married. Mm-hmm.
So where did you meet your wife?
In high school.
Oh.
Eighth grade.
Wow.
Eighth grade sweethearts.
Oh my goodness.
Next year will be 60 years.
60 years, wow. That's amazing. That's amazing. So, so tell me about your experiences when you got to Indianapolis in terms of medical school. What was your, did you have mostly lectures in your sophomore and junior year? Or did you begin to have patient contact?
It was mostly lectures. Pathology was the, excuse me, pathology was the biggie.
Yes.
And I'm trying to recall what else we did. Oh, biochemistry.
Uh-huh.
Microbiology.
Uh-huh.
We were still, no, we didn't have hardly any patient contact during the sophomore year. Pharmacology. Uh-huh. Pharmacology, microbiology, pathology. Those were the ones that I can remember off the top of my head.
Yeah, I've heard pathology was very difficult for a lot of people.
I wouldn't call it difficult. It was interesting, and I remember the professors very well.
Yeah. What are some of the ones that stick out in
you? Dr. Smith, Dr. Beamer, Dr. Forey.
Dr. Forey, yeah. I've heard other...
You can't forget Dr. Forey.
That's what I've heard more than once, yes. Well, why can't you forget him? What was
it
about him?
He used to stand up on the microscope tables and jump from table to table.
Oh my goodness, I've never heard that.
And look down on us and see what we were doing.
Watch you.
He wasn't real tall.
Uh-huh.
And he'd always tell us to look up things we didn't know.
Uh-huh.
Don't let 24 hours go by, he'd say.
Oh, wow. So then your junior year, was that the year that you
had patient contact.
You had more patient contact.
Quite a bit. Quite a bit of patient contact.
And so you went through the different specialty areas then in your junior year?
Yes.
And was that when you came out here to the Central State, was your junior year?
It was when I was at LaRue Carter in the clerkship for neuropsychiatry.
Mm-hmm.
They bust us out here.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess they wanted us to see what it was like to be in an insane asylum, basically. That's what this was at that time, as I can recall.
So what were your impressions when you were out here?
It was pretty bleak.
And did you go on the through the wards then?
We did. I remember we went through the female wards. I think we went through both the male and female.
So you came out here like more than once or one time? Or?
No, it was just once that I can recall.
Okay.
Well, no, I think there may have been two. There may have been two times, but it wasn't frequent. We didn't come out here often.
Okay.
But I do remember it well.
And what kind of stood out to you? Had that been your first experience with people who had mental illness, or?
It was very sad.
It was very sad?
Yeah.
Yeah.
We learned about tertiary syphilis. This seemed to be prevalent here. A lot of the patients had that, and there was no real treatment when it was that advanced.
Right.
There was treatment for primary and secondary, but treatment for these people was not really helpful. A lot of the people were not. A lot of people were not afflicted with that disease, but a lot of them were. They brought patients into the amphitheater for us to see. The first they would present the case and tell us what they were going to do, so the patient wouldn't be aware of what was going on.
Right.
Then they bring the patient in and we could ask the patients questions. And then the patient would leave, and then we discuss what went on. That's about all I remember about the amphitheater.
Right.
And that they'd bring in maybe four or five patients.
And what was your, so this was part of your clerkship at LaRue Carter?
Yes, as I recall.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
How was that? Like a month-long clerkship, or how long was your clerkship at LaRue Carter?
I think it was six weeks or 12 weeks.
Okay. And how did that differ from LaRue Carter? How did this experience out here differ from LaRue Carter?
Oh, completely different. These people were, what should I say? I don't want to say they were incarcerated, but they were here for the rest of their life,
right.
Most of these people.
Right. There was an idea they weren't going to get better.
They were not going to leave.
Right. Mm-hmm. Whereas at LaRue Carter, there was more of a focus on treatment. Is that what you're...
That's true. It was a little depressing here, going through the wards and seeing these people.
Right. So what did your clerkship entail when you were at LaRue Carter? What types of things did you do?
Well, we did histories and physicals on the patients. Most of them were able to converse with us.
And
I don't recall too much from LaRue Carter, I really don't. The wards were locked, as I recall, so the patients wouldn't wander off. But it was completely different from out here.
Right.
Completely different.
Right.
We could discuss things with the patients. The patients here were bizarre.
Well, knowing a little bit about your subsequent career, I know that this didn't inspire you to a life of working in this area?
No, and treatment for a lot of the tertiary syphilis had already been devised and just didn't see it anymore.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So these people were historical people,
right.
Patients
right.
who really had a disease that now we don't see anymore.
Right. Right.
It's gone.
In our modern era, we really don't think about incurable diseases, and it's just a different way of thinking about it.
As soon as penicillin came around,
that
was the end of tertiary syphilis and all syphilis, really.
Yeah, yeah. But you're right. But it would take a time for that transition to happen for the people who already had the tertiary syphilis. So. Right.
That was a physical thing.
Yeah.
The damage was already
done
and nobody corrected.
Right.
The uncorrectable central nervous system problems.
Right.
Spinal and central.
So what other clerkships stood out from that time period that you did?
Well, I was interested in obstetrics and gynecology.
Right.
And I did urology. Pediatrics was very, very good, very interesting.
What was pediatrics?
Broad Hospital.
What kind of things did you do in your pediatrics clerkship?
Well, we still saw a lot of infantile paralysis patients, patients that had residual.
Right.
And that.
So, when did your were you interested in obstetrics and gynecology before your clerkship, or did that kind of cement your interest in that area?
Yes, it did. And I worked at a community hospital when it was first opened.
Mm-hmm.
There was probably six or eight of us who kind of ran the emergency room and took care of the needs of the nurses on the floors. And I did a lot of deliveries at community hospital when I was a medical student. And that's when I decided I wanted to do OB.
Yeah, and then you said was it your son or daughter that would have been, didn't your child, wasn't
was,
your child?
My daughter was born in 1957.
So it would have been about the same time then, yeah. Mm-hmm. So, then what about your senior year? What did that entail? Was it more clerkship rotations?
More clerkship rotations. Kind of a carbon copy of the junior year, as I recall, except we didn't go to Lou Carter. We had an internal medicine clerkship both times in both years. And I think maybe at Coleman Hospital both years.
What was Coleman Hospital like at this time?
It was small. One of the smaller hospitals. We had a medical clerkship at Long Hospital, right next door.
Right.
Coleman Hospital was both a private hospital and a university hospital because a lot of the obstetricians in private practice used Coleman Hospital, as well as the staff that was teaching and the residents. So they took care of the private patients and they taught the residents and the interns and the medical students.
So, at the middle, what was the internship application process like at this time?
The internship application process. Well,
or
this was the time of the Berry Plan. when the military needed physicians badly, and they were offering a program called the Senior Medical Student Program. You went on active duty during your last year of medical school and got credit for that, and you got paid. And that was good.
Yes, that would be good.
A lot of the medical students were needy in my generation.
Uh-huh.
And so I joined that, and then my internship was secured in the Army. I took an Army internship, and after graduation went to Brick General Hospital in San Antonio, did my internship there.
And what, in general medicine or in, you said?
The internships at that time were general.
General?
You studied everything. Mm-hmm. You were a doctor then.
Mm-hmm.
We already graduated.
Right.
Had MD after our name.
Was that a funny or scary feeling when you first started?
No? No, we were all proud.
Yeah.
And that year, was kind of a blur because we worked so hard. They worked us heavily. Took care of a lot of patients. That was 1958-59. And then in March 59, our son was born at the Army Hospital.
So you were able to bring your wife with you?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We had a house.
So then where were you after San Antonio?
After San Antonio, after I finished my residency, I went to Fort MacArthur Army Hospital in Los Angeles. And I was the chief of OBGYN at Fort MacArthur for 2 years, until 1964. And then I went to Europe for 3 years.
Still as a part of the Army?
Oh yeah, on sale.
Yeah.
Had to pay back your
right.
Your time.
Right.
And so we spent 3 years in Würzburg. I was able to do OBGYN all the time. And then we got out of the Army in 1967. And went back to Los Angeles. I met a doctor that he was a consultant at Fort MacArthur Hospital, and I went into practice with him. And then we stayed there, I'm trying to think, until 1997. Practiced about 30 some years there.
And so was that a general OBGYN practice or?
Did surgery, gynecologic surgery, office gynecology and obstetrics. The subspecialties in OBGYN didn't happen until somewhere in the middle there.
Okay, so like in the 80s?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. So, just going back to your time as a OBGYN with the Army, that's really fascinating to me. I hadn't really thought about that, but all of these families would have needed treatment.
Yeah.
Yeah, so then you were predominantly treating like the wives of soldiers? Is that what you were? Okay.
Completely. Mm-hmm.
Completely, because there, and so.
That was during the Vietnam War.
Right. That's what I was just thinking.
Made us Vietnam veterans.
Right. Right. My dad was in the Army during this time too. So mm-hmm. yeah, the later he started in 67. So a little bit, your careers wouldn't have overlapped. But
is he a physician?
No, he he was a tactical officer at Fort Benning for all. So he trained guys to go over to Vietnam. So that was, I think, really hard on him to be safe stateside and know he was sending all these boys overseas. So we hear a lot of scandals about the military system of healthcare system now. What was military healthcare like during the time you practiced?
It was superb. Compared to what we have now,
right.
I would say it was the best.
Really?
We had five or six big army hospitals, mm-hmm. and then Bethesda Navy Hospital.
Uh-huh.
These were all excellent training hospitals.
Uh-huh.
Physicians were all good.
Uh-huh.
It has changed.
Right.
And I'm not too familiar with the way
right.
it is now,
right.
but I know it has changed.
Right.
Walter Reed, I had a lot of friends that took the residency there.
Uh-huh.
My former chief of service from Walter Reed.
Uh-huh. All right, so let's move on to your practice in LA. So you decided to settle there. And this would have been, you said, in 67. So medicine was, even though you had only been graduated, a decade, I guess, or not quite,
mm-hmm.
There was becoming a lot of changes in your field during this time, wasn't there? I'm not too familiar with it, but...
Yes, it always changes.
Yeah.
Ultrasound came.
Right.
I can't remember the exact year, but that was a big change in obstetrics.
Right.
We didn't have it when I was training.
So how did you get training in it? Did they have a machine at one of the...
Oh, yeah, you take courses,
uh-huh.
postgraduate courses.
Okay.
That was one of the big changes in obstetrics.
What, from a physician's point of view, what was so significant about the ultrasound in terms of changing the field?
Well, we could diagnose placenta previa ahead of time. We didn't have to wait till the emergency
mm-hmm.
happened. That was very, very helpful. Patients could go into the laboratory during their latter trimester and give blood.
Mm-hmm.
So if they did need blood, they didn't have to rely on taking the risk of other people's
mm-hmm.
blood.
Mm-hmm.
Blood transfusions were fairly safe now
mm-hmm.
at that time.
Mm-hmm.
But ultrasound, we could tell some abnormalities that we couldn't tell ahead of time before.
Mm-hmm.
Placenta previa, as I mentioned, we could pick up twins real early instead of having to wait until the second trimester
mm-hmm.
and do it physical with physical examination. We could see two babies early.
Uh-huh.
If abnormalities were suspected, we could do karyotypes on patients. By amniocentesis.
Mm-hmm.
And check the chromosomes.
Mm-hmm. When did
couldn't
that?
I do that before.
Right.
I don't know the exact year that happened, but I think it was in the 80s.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's.
And patients that were older that were getting pregnant, we'd do that on all of them at that time. That that was a big change because the picking up Down syndrome and that sort of thing.
Did. So it seems like these new tests kind of started to raise some ethical questions or change some of the issues related to the relationship. I mean, was that an issue about people like thinking about their pregnancies different or the doctors thinking about it differently?
I'm not quite sure what you're driving at.
Well, I guess I'm just questioning from like a beyond just diagnosis, did it change the relationship with the physicians and their patients differently, being able to know these things in advance?
I don't think so.
Okay.
Patients had to adjust to abnormalities sometimes when we would have them. And, I don't think so.
Okay. I was just thinking that the first time I saw in the ultrasound the babies when I was pregnant, it kind of changed the way I thought about my pregnancy, being able to visualize that. I just wondered, having been a physician in a time before ultrasound and after ultrasound, did that kind of visualization change your thoughts about it?
Patients like knowing if it's a boy or a girl.
Yeah.
They pick the name early.
Yeah.
And that sort of thing. That didn't change my thinking.
It didn't. Okay. Well, we think about it.
Sometimes they made mistakes. Sometimes
right.
If we would send the patient to radiology and they'd say, "Well, it looks like a boy." And once in a while, they make an error. They don't do that anymore, I don't think.
No.
I think that's pretty. But when it first started, sometimes they did make mistakes.
All right. I like jumped ahead on. I haven't even looked at my questions for a while because I've been just so interested. I've done a little bit of reading about obstetrics and gynecology in this time, and I know a lot of people had different views on the increasing availability of different birth control methods. Was that a big issue in your practice?
Well, birth control is very popular. The birth control pill, actually, the first one was the Novid. And that actually came at during my residency. So it's been with us a long time.
It has, yeah. I think people don't realize.
And it's still with us.
Yeah.
Birth control pills are still one of the predominant methods of birth control. Intrauterine devices never really were... what should I say, commonly used.
Right.
A lot of people use them, but there are a lot of complications.
Mm-hmm.
I think birth control pills were used more.
Now, the gynecological surgery became increasingly common during your time, from my understanding. Was that your experience, that you did more, like...
I did a fair amount of... GYN surgery.
Predominantly, what were some of the common surgeries that you performed?
Surgeries for bleeding, infertility, cancer.
There were huge advances in knowledge about cancer over your career, I would assume. Don't know too much about, knowledge change about cancer, like uterine cancers and things, over your career?
Chemotherapy. Again, I think chemotherapy became popular, and more in the 80s, chemotherapy for GYN malignancies wasn't too necessary because one of the most common ones was cervical cancer. And we did change the way cervical cancer was treated from the 50s and 60s until the 80s because of different modalities for treating cervical cancer, and much more successful. Of course, back in Nicholas smears were used by everyone.
Right.
Still are. A lot of controversy about whether to continue with that or not, or how often they ought to be done.
So what are some of your favorite memories from your time in Los Angeles, from your practice? Are there things that stick out in your mind?
Not really.
No.
Just the people I met and, and the patients. Nothing really salient.
Nothing really salient. So how did you see a really big difference in the women coming into your practice? I mean, you know, from when you first started till you retired, how were the women different in terms of approaching like their relationship with their physicians? And
not really.
Not really?
Mm-mm. Okay. No, we, the church was kind of a general practitioner for women.
Yeah.
A big referral source.
Yeah. Oh, that's interesting that, I mean, that I know that's really common today, but you found that even earlier on in your career.
All the way.
Right. So a lot of times you were treating the whole woman and, like, dealing with other issues that they might have. Okay. So when did you retire then?
I retired from obstetrics in 1994 and from gynecology, and completely, 1997.
Okay. And why did you decide to retire when you did?
It was time.
It was time.
Things were changing.
Uh-huh.
Medicine was changing a lot. It was, I think, the things that are driving doctors to retire now and retire a little early were the same.
So related to insurance, related to...
All of that.
Yeah.
And I was just getting older. Didn't like staying up at night.
Yeah, yeah. So that is one downside, I would think, to being in this field would be the surprise. Lots of weekends, that's family right. time, and
yeah, that's exactly right. It's taxing.
Yeah. So, did you? But there's been a rise in C-sections have kind of come and gone in favor over your career several times.
I certainly have.
Yeah.
We can blame a lot of that on legal situation, I guess.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Always ran around 7 or 8% when I was practicing.
Okay. So you, well, overall they went up and down, you found over your...
It's much higher now.
Yeah. Yeah. But you kind of tended to be fairly steady over the course
pretty
of your
steady,
career.
Yeah.
And what about the trend towards having older mothers and more fertility treatments and things? Did you see that as a big factor in your practice?
Yes, a lot of patients put off childbearing until they were older, and it's kind of nice that we could do karyotypes and amniocentesis and reassure them they didn't have a Down syndrome baby or something wrong.
Yeah.
And I think health. Women's health had improved through the years, and so that helped older patients deliver easier.
Oh, I've never really thought about that. And what do you mean? Their overall health or?
Just the importance of health. Everybody seemed to stress that.
Uh-huh.
And more exercise,
mm-hmm.
better diet,
mm-hmm.
all these things helped.
Yeah.
Help with deliveries.
Yeah.
And patients' complications went down.
Hmm.
Toxemia was more controlled.
Uh-huh.
We've never been able to obliterate it, but it was controlled.
Southern California, I know, was the home of the kind of midwife revival movement in the late 60s and the 70s. Did you have much interaction with the midwife community in your...
No.
Okay. All right. So you didn't connect with very many midwives or anything?
No.
Okay. Interesting.
Not in California.
Okay.
California was... a lot of legal problems in California, and I don't recall midwives in California.
Okay, all right. But you did in Germany, I would assume. Or were you in Germany, you said, I think?
In Germany, we were at the military.
Right, and did you...
Hospital.
And you didn't have midwives there?
No.
Okay.
Just like here.
Just like here. So do you keep in contact with any of the people from your class at IU over the years?
My peer pressure is decreasing.
Yes, I imagine. Imagine.
I just heard of a death today of one of my classmates.
And what about for your, from your, I imagine you kept in touch more closely with your colleagues from your military career? Have you?
Not really.
Not really?
No, more the other way around.
Oh, really?
Yeah. More in contact with the people I knew in civilian life.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. Looking back over your career, what has surprised you the most over how your career went, or were there any things that surprised you?
I'm thinking.
Okay.
Well, in California, in 1975, we had a big change. I'll tell you about this. In 1975, all the professional liability companies decided they would no longer underwrite professional liability insurance in the state of California. This is why we didn't have midwives in California. I didn't want to disagree with you, but I don't think we had a lot of midwives in California.
I think it was 69, 70 when there was the mm-hmm. lawsuits in California over the midwives.
And so the legal situation was one of the biggest factors impacting obstetricians.
Mm-hmm.
We had to form our own professional liability insurance company in California. That was a big big happening.
Wow.
And to this day, the doctor's company and Skippy are still functioning in California. The professional liability crisis that occurred in 1975.
And was there rumblings of this happening prior to 1975, or did it kind of, so there were problems you experienced with liability issues, and this was...
Hospitals too. The hospitals had a lot of them closed. They just couldn't continue, or couldn't afford to pay the insurance, or couldn't get insurance.
And so were you in a small group?
We called it the professional liability crisis. That's what they call it.
Okay.
But you ask what I could remember, and that was one of the biggest things that impacted my practice.
Uh-huh.
We had to, and then of course the cost, cost of insurance.
So were you in a small practice with a small number of doctors?
Yes, solo practice.
Oh, a solo practice.
Solo practices are things of the past now.
Yes.
I shared night call with other physicians, and they with I.
So I imagine this insurance crisis was particularly challenging for a solo practice.
It impacted all the doctors.
All the doctors.
Everybody.
And
a lot of them quit. A lot of them left the state. It's similar to what's happening now with the government in or governmental influence in medicine.
Right. So was this predominantly an issue for obstetricians, or was this across the board for doctors?
Across the board. Uh-oh. It was across the board, but some specialties have more exposure to liability, like neurosurgeons and obstetricians, plastic surgeons.
Hmm.
Are you closed today?
All right. Is there anything else you would like to add?
No, I'm retired, and when you're retired, you don't get any time off.
Oh. Yeah? What do you mean by that?
Busy.
You keep busy with
I keep busy, yes. It's just a joke.
Oh, it's just a joke. Oh, I remember there was one other thing I wanted to ask you about. So the licensing process, because I know that probably changed over your career, and the subspecialties. I noticed you wrote several subspecialties after your name, so I was wanting you to...
Those are just American College of Surgeons and American College of OBGYN.
Okay.
I was a life fellow of the Los Angeles OBGYN Society, and I'm a life fellow of the American College of Surgeons, a life fellow of the American College of OBGYN, and I have a license in Indiana still, an active license here, and a retired license in California.
All right. Well, thank you so much for this interview. This has been really interesting. Thank you so much.